want to thank everybody for being here. So I was really trying to do two things with this presentation. First, talk about why there's a mounting crisis in the United States, not just economically, but politically. It's, I would say it's an emerging crisis at this point. It could be worse, of course. Things can always be worse. But also, what's impeding or stopping or preventing some sort of transformational change in American politics and society? So we are in a crisis period, I think, an emerging crisis, whether people recognize it or not. I think a lot of people don't, if you look at public opinion polls. But there are enough people that are beginning to recognize some of the problems we're facing that we can start to talk about prospects for change. I really don't think that we're further than that at this point in terms of mapping out any sort of major societal transformation in institutions. So in some sense, that is very encouraging because it means there's all types of possibilities that are hopeful, but also we're not where we need to be or even close to it, so that's very challenging as well. It can be somewhat frustrating and depressing. So everything I'm going to say here in terms of where the system is going, our political and economic system, we have to understand this is tentative. We're looking at one point in time where things could change in terms of the prospects for some sort of major upheaval in society or transformation or revolutionary politics. That may or may not happen. A lot of people on the left like to say that look at politics only in terms of revolutionary change, and that may happen, it may not, but what I'm talking about here is where we are headed if we don't change what we're currently doing and what we've been seeing. So I think when we talk about crisis, there's really basically about four points I was thinking about that would, I think, reveal that there is a crisis going on. Now, a lot of people haven't really thought about these things, but they're worth thinking about. Number one is economic growth. We now live in a period where this system can no longer produce the kind of economic growth that people expect it to provide for not only corporate profits, but a rising standard of living for the average person. In the United States, people have long liked to pride themselves in this idea that if you work hard, you can get ahead, and that requires significant economic growth and profits, and we are at a point now where if you look at the last 10 years, 2008 to 2016, we've averaged during that period about 1.2% economic growth per year, which means you've entered a period of stagnation. That barely surpasses population growth, which is around 1% a year in the United States. Why does that matter? Well, you know, if you're advocating for a system outside of capitalism, it doesn't necessarily matter if you're not seeing significant economic growth past population growth per year. You could certainly make an argument for systems that don't require growth past population growth in terms of your economy, but this system is based on that, the idea of ever-increasing profits. And this system no longer exists on a level that can provide for not only economic growth, but growth for individuals in terms of growing incomes and corporate profits. So it's a stagnant system. And the system is based on growth and growth in profits and growth in people's incomes in terms of expectations. And we don't have that anymore. If you want a comparison point, you can look at the 1940s through the 1990s. And you can see that the economic growth rate per year in that period, there was a range, a low of about 4% to a high of about 7.5% a year. So now we're talking about 1.2%. This is the weakest growth we've ever seen in post-World War II history, year after year. So that's important, you know, that the system isn't able to sustain what people have expected it to sustain in the past. We also need to talk about financialization. The rise of financialization means that you have banks and finance sector and investors who have basically become the predominant part of the American economy. Well, why is that a concern? Because with the lack of regulation, you're talking about cycles now of instability and a growth now of what you might call structural instability in the sense that without regulating the banks and ownership rules for the banks and creating actual situations where banks can become, they won't become too big to fail. If you don't have these kinds of ownership rules and restrictions to regulate these banks, then they'll do what they want and think that they'll get bailed out if they engage in all types of speculation. And without regulations, we have this kind of speculative-based economy today where with finance running the economy, it's not that these individuals are any longer making things, they're just speculating on investments. Whether we're talking about the internet tech bubble of the 1990s, which crashed by 2000, or the housing bubble, or what's going to come next. We seem to be averaging one every decade now. Is it going to be housing again? Is it going to be a student loan bubble this next time around? I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe it'll be a combination of things or something we haven't seen before. But with the rise of speculative finance, we're now seeing a pattern of this boom and bust economy during a time where the economy itself is just no longer very strong in terms of talking about this 1% growth. So this adds more instability to what we're already talking about in terms of this anemic growth. Add to that economic insecurity, and you've got now three problems. We live in an era of record profits, but also record inequality. And if there isn't really economic growth to outpace population growth, so where are these record profits coming from then? If it's not really coming from economic growth, well, the simple answer would be cannibalism, to put it metaphorically, that companies have found a way to make record profits without really much of any economic growth. They do that by going after things like workers, salaries, incomes, pensions, benefits, forcing people to work longer for less money, the rise of this alternative work economy or gig economy, as it's called. These are all important things to point out here. And it is a broken economy, whether people realize it or not. There was a recent Princeton study that found in the last 10 years, 94% of the new jobs created were alternative work arrangement jobs, which mean that they were either people on call or on contracts, temporary workers, freelance. Why does this matter? Well, some of these jobs pay pretty well. A lot of them, many of them don't. I can speak from my own experiences in higher education, talking about people who are non-tenure track faculty, who adjunct and they get paid nearly nothing. They have no benefits in terms of retirement or barely any. Healthcare benefits, basically non-existent. Low pay that qualifies people with graduate degrees for welfare benefits. So this is an economy that's really fundamentally different than the idea of a career-based economy, that 94% of new jobs in the last decade have been alternative work arrangements. It means this economy does not function for the average person any longer. I think if you put these things together, what we are seeing now with the American public is a vague sort of anger that's been emerging in the last, particularly the last decade, really, in post-2008. If the 2000s were marked by, especially the early 2000s, sort of a suspension of disbelief with 9/11 and the war on terrorism, and this idea that you have to be patriotic and not criticize your president or your government, we've really moved to the opposite of that, where we have a record amount of anger and distrust of governments, major business entities, corporations. And to give you some examples of this, we now have a president who came into office with the lowest approval rating of a president in history. Well, we could say history of recorded polls, right? Since post-World War II. We've never seen a president this unpopular coming into office. He's somewhere in the 30s now, less than, really about 6 months into this administration. That's incredible. We've never seen that before in modern times. A third of Americans in some recent polls say that they're optimistic about the future and about the U.S. economy. So when I say there's this vague sense of anger and distrust, that's an indication of it. Only one-third of Americans say they admire wealthy people or rich people, so there's this vague sense of distrust when it comes to wealth as well. Two-thirds of Americans approximately say inequality is too high, and most say government should do something about it to fix it. It starts to get complicated when you get into the actual details, especially when you have people voting for parties, in this case, a Republican or Democratic Party, that have been committed to increasing inequality in recent decades. So, but we're talking about general principles here, not the sort of the gears of how this all works in governments. 3/4 of Americans say that they think businesses and corporations have too much power. So these are the kinds of metrics I'm talking about when I say that there is a generalized, somewhat vague sense of anger and distrust in the United States that could be capitalized on if done properly. One other thing, ecological crisis. This is not something I focus a huge amount in my work, but it is something that we need to talk about. On the current path, if we don't make the changes that we need to in terms of runaway climate change, that, in my mind, would probably represent, and I think does represent, the biggest existential crisis to this system we're talking about that has existed in this country. Politically, economically, you're talking about entire societies and civilizations under pressure, stress, potentially collapsing. Depending on the scientific estimates, we're talking about right now a range of ideas somewhere between 2 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming over the next century through 2100, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the big intergovernmental group that deals with these projections, they have said, well, in order to avoid more than 2 degrees of warming, which is considered anything past that as becoming radically dangerous in terms of human sustainability and other species, and environmental sustainability in general. In order to avoid more than that, we would have to have a leveling off of CO2 emissions by 2030, which is what this Paris Accord was supposed to be about, which we are not on pace right now to meet, especially if we don't recognize that it exists as something that binds us, which we don't anymore. And a total elimination of CO2 emissions by 2070 to 2100, complete elimination. If we don't do these things, the projections that we're hearing about in terms of effects are getting pretty frightening. Predictions for coastlines and flooding and coastal flooding of somewhere between 30 to 80 feet. A global displacement of the human population of maybe as much as a fifth or more. 1 in 5 people being displaced. Up to a third of the U.S. corn crop being destroyed, at least, maybe more, depending on if these estimates, well, they might be worse than some of the conservative estimates scientists have made in terms of how much warming we're going to see. Half of people throughout the world dealing with the problem of severe water shortages by 2050, which is not that far away, realistically. Another recent study, a peer-reviewed study, said that if you talk about the hottest days, the unusual days in the United States and elsewhere between 1950 and 1980, which occurred only about 5% of the time, that those would become regular. Those would become something that would occur 70% of the time by 2035 to 2064 if we don't take the drastic steps that are needed to deal with this problem. And we've already heard scientists begin to talk about a sixth mass extinction event in the last 450 million years, that we're in the middle of it right now. So regardless of whether Americans want another system or any system, we're rapidly moving toward an intensifying of the crisis within this system, especially when you have an economy and an economic system based on the idea of endless growth based on fossil fuels. So it's possible that all of these things I'm talking about could change in the next 20 to 30 years with mass action and pressure, that a system, some sort of capitalistic system, could continue with progressive New Deal kind of reforms economically and politically, and also with mass action on climate change. I'm not so silly or naive that I'm going to say that the system that we live under can't adapt or reform, because it has in the past. Under the current trajectory, the system is doomed. Whether people want to recognize that or not, it's going to happen, at the very least ecologically. So where does that leave us? Well, it's a problem in terms of climate change, because only half of Americans recognize that global warming is man-made, or human-made, if you want to say. So how do you deal with a problem that people don't recognize exists? You can't deal with it until there's a stronger critical mass consciousness, and I think that's going to be one of the big challenges moving forward in the next 10 to 15 years, and now it is. What about economically? Well, 60% of Americans, if you look at some of the recent Pew and Gallup surveys, say that they have a positive view of capitalism, which is a majority, but it's not as big of a majority as I thought you might see in contemporary times, in light of people's commitment to this economic system over recent decades. To say 60%, that's interesting. 35% of Americans say they have a positive view of socialism. Now, we don't really know what that means in terms of this poll, these polls they ask, because these groups like Pew and Gallup, they just throw out these terms. What do you think about capitalism? What do you think about socialism? Well, people have a pretty good idea what capitalism is, but what socialism would be or could be, that's a whole different matter of discussion and fleshing out. What I think is interesting, though, is if you look at a recent Harvard poll, 2016, half of millennials said that they don't support and they don't like the idea of capitalism. And it's a significantly higher number than if you look at other age cohorts. And I think that the reason why this is happening is because people between 18 to, I guess you could say, maybe 35, or 18 to 29, depending on how these pollsters measure the age categories, they've experienced a fundamentally different type of economy than someone would have in the 1940s, 1950s, and 60s, and 70s, prior to the modern era of rising inequality and worker insecurity. So whereas people who are in older age groups are much less likely to say they like the idea of socialism or that they dislike capitalism, we have a fundamental disconnect culturally in the United States with millennials because they have had to deal with this modern dysfunctional economy and system more than anyone else in terms of record student debts, record inequality, massive increases in healthcare costs way beyond inflation and beyond people's income earnings. So they have felt the failure of the system. And if there is an alternative that's going to develop to our system today that we have, this capitalist system, I think that that potential lies with younger Americans, the ones who have felt this disconnect. So I think we're really at a crossroads here. Where we go, who knows? That's going to depend on whether people are active or not. But there has been talk of an uprising, right? We've heard that. But it's sort of strange because apparently the uprising includes people as radical leftist as Noam Chomsky to as sort of center-right as Hillary Clinton. She decided she was part of the resistance too. So what is this resistance? What is it? I had sort of mixed feelings about it until fairly recently because, to be honest, until really the last month or two, I thought it was largely reactionary. And I don't know how you build a positive future based on simply reacting to someone like Donald Trump, as reprehensible as he may be and is. So really it was largely reactionary, so you can't really talk about a transformational society or politics or economics if you're purely reacting to society becoming more reactionary, right-wing, moving more in that direction. So this uprising is interesting and I think potentially exciting in some sense, but also there are a lot of limits to it too. So is it an uprising? Is it transformational? Potentially, maybe, depending on where it goes. I think it's just starting to get interesting. On the one hand, you know, if you go back and you look at these protests, which I've been involved at every stage of these protests over the last 6 to 8 months, November, they were purely anti-Trump, purely. If you go look at protests that were going on across the country after he was elected, it was purely, we don't like Donald Trump, we're against sexism, racism, homophobia, and so on. Most of the protests that I was involved in and saw and read about, they didn't really talk a lot about militarism or rising inequality, so they were extremely limited in talking more about identity politics issues, and there's nothing wrong with talking about those issues, but without talking about inequality or militarism, it's limited. This continued through January. I'm happy to say I was at the late January inauguration protests in D.C. It was an encouraging moment in terms of what estimates said were maybe 500,000 to 750,000 people who showed up. It's definitely the biggest protest I've ever seen or been a part of in Washington, D.C. or anywhere else. I was encouraged to see that there were a very wide range of different types of activists involved, whether we're talking about racially, in terms of age, a very eclectic group of people. So there was potential there for this to become something positive and proactive and not just something reacting to Donald Trump. If we're talking about January through February and the protests of the travel ban, again, still largely reacting to what Donald Trump was doing, I think it's gotten interesting since then, or more interesting. By the time April came around, we started seeing these marches for science. And this was the first indication I really saw that there was something positive building here, where the protests that I was involved in and demonstrations, people said, we're not just against Donald Trump being anti-science. We're also in favor of prioritizing spending on things like education and healthcare. That was definitely a big message on the East Coast for the protests that I was at in demonstrations. So that's, well, finally, we're starting to see something, and it's relatively early in these protests, so that's good that we're seeing it earlier on. Really, this month has been the first time where I would say I'm really starting to see an even stronger build towards something really proactive. And I've seen this on the East Coast, and I live in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, so I've pretty much been spending my time between there and D.C., that area of the country, but largely the Lehigh Valley area in Pennsylvania, which includes Bethlehem and Allentown. And another of, many people who have been hurt by deindustrialization, really. Loss of manufacturing jobs, radical rise in inequality. And it's really something impossible to miss if you've ever traveled through towns like Allentown or Bethlehem, how much they've been hurt by rising inequality and deindustrialization. And we're not seeing, I would say, a push toward this idea that suddenly these steel jobs are going to come back to the area, contrary to what Donald Trump said about my concern is Pittsburgh, not Paris. That's not what people are talking about in that area. What they are talking about are things like universal health care. So the protests that I've been involved in demonstrations in July, it was very energizing and optimistic for me in the sense that not only were people talking about, well, we don't want the Affordable Care Act repealed. I mean, that's certainly something. There were things about that law, as critical as I've been of it, that were very important. Expanding Medicaid, particularly, getting rid of this ability to deny people care based on pre-existing conditions. Those were really hugely important things, that if this bill did nothing else, the Affordable Care Act, I think it would have been worth it to do those things. Is it a solution to American healthcare problems? Obviously not, I think. But what was interesting in these protests and in these gatherings is that there was a recognition on the part of activists that we're not fighting a reactionary battle here to preserve the Affordable Care Act. It was recognized that that was a concession that Democrats made to Republicans for some sort of market-based healthcare. But the idea here is healthcare is a human right. That was the theme. That's been the theme. And not just healthcare as a human right in some abstract sense, but healthcare as a human right in terms of universal healthcare. That's where we need to go. That's where the fight is going. That we want to build up community support across the country for nonprofit-based universal healthcare in which everyone has access to it as a right. Now, is that going to happen everywhere? I don't know. I'm observing protests in one part of the country, but that's where, obviously, I think we need to go. We're talking about a real resistance to the rightward movement of the United States and the rise of record inequality. So in that sense, there's some really encouraging things going on. We'll see where they go. What is stopping quicker change? Because I think that most people would probably agree, if we're talking about rising inequality and the rise of the Trump administration, that we have been moving in the wrong direction for some time now, for decades, especially in recent years with the rise of Donald Trump. So why is it, why is it that we haven't seen more positive change? And that's what I was thinking about in terms of preparing for this presentation. I wanted to talk about some things that I think get to the root of what the problem is. If we can address these issues, then there's going to be a better potential to move forward in terms of a real progressive transformation. One is that people just need to put in more effort in terms of questioning political leaders. While technically we live in an era where people say they're hugely distrustful of government, a lot of that is skin deep and superficial. I hear people endlessly talking about how they can't trust government and they're all crooks. Recently in the case of Illinois, I've heard numerous family members talk about how, well, Bruce Rauner might be a crook, but they're all crooks. And my response is, have you paid attention to what's happened in the last few years? Illinois in danger of being degraded in terms of its debt to junk bond status. Institutions, higher learning particularly, and all types of nonprofit civil society organizations providing hugely important social services, whether it's drug treatments or child care, or all types of other benefits people rely on. These services being eviscerated for the lack of a budget. I used to live in Illinois, in Springfield, Illinois, and I would sit through regularly House and Senate committee meetings where these groups would come in front of the House and Senate and plead and beg for revenues and warning that they're going to have to shut their doors. And a number of these organizations have already shut down. And when we're talking about higher education, many colleges and universities in the state that have been reliant on state funding are on the brink of either shutting down, particularly Chicago State, or laying off large numbers of faculty, which has happened across the board, or losing even their accreditation, which has become a big concern for a lot of these universities. The point I'm making here is that things can always be worse. They've gotten even worse under the Rauner administration, as hard as that is to believe, with patronage politics in Illinois. And I'm talking to these family members, they've got this sort of very general, vague sense of, well, things have always been bad and they're all crooks. It's like, well, there are levels of corruption and crookedness, and we got to pay attention to these things. Otherwise, these things happen, and then it's too late. You have this scorched earth policy, where if you're talking about higher education particularly, the Democrats in Illinois and legislatures throughout this country have been pursuing a sort of death of a thousand cuts approach to education for decades now, with the decline of tenure and the decline of funding and the rise in tuition costs. And Rauner has a sort of hatchet to the skull approach, which is kill the whole thing in a year or two if you can. So the point is that people need to pay more attention. And a lot of the problem that I think that comes up is that oftentimes if you're not paying close attention, it's very easy for people to get propagandized and manipulated. You have a lot of Americans who consider themselves supporters of the Democratic Party, who during the Obama years fell victim to a lot of his and the party's rhetoric about helping Americans. And what really happened during that era was that we saw a massive increase in inequality. That's a fact, that in the last 10 years, we saw the rise of the alternative jobs economy and the rise of mass inequality and the further growing of costs for things like higher education and healthcare, despite the Affordable Care Act, which was a Band-Aid on a larger problem of a for-profit healthcare system. This administration, the Obama administration, promised to fix the problem of American jobs with rising unemployment. We really haven't seen that with the rise of the alternative work arrangements. That has not happened. He promised to fix the healthcare problem with an Affordable Care Act, which has provided neither affordable care or even care for still tens of millions of Americans, like a universal healthcare system would. The costs continue to go up, approximately 10% a year, even accounting for inflation, even with this law, which did nothing to regulate healthcare premiums and costs, as it could have, at the very least. Anti-war rhetoric, which people bought and ate up hook, line, and sinker during the 2008 election. This president, President Obama, spent more on the military and on foreign wars than George Bush did. In his first 4 years in office, Obama spent more than Bush did in the first 4 years after 9/11. You think about that for a minute. He won a Nobel Peace Prize based on the premise that he was going to stop these silly wars in the Middle East. And then he continued to fight these wars and expanded them. And he expanded programs like drone strikes, targeted assassination, which were illegal under international law and still are. So there was a lot of good rhetoric coming out of the Obama administration. There were some things the Obama administration did to help the United States, whether we're talking about a stimulus that prevented an even further economic decline that would have happened with, in light of the 2008 economic crash. There were some things that were done that were a help in terms of this health care law, but really nothing, nowhere near enough to deal with the problem of rising inequality. And if you look at the approval rating for this administration going out of office, Obama left office with an almost 60% approval rating, because people looked at the incoming administration and said, my God, he looks like a saint compared to this guy. Well, maybe he certainly looks a lot less terrible than Donald Trump, but this is a continuation of something that's been going on for 30 to 40 years, rising inequality, worker insecurity, radically growing healthcare and education costs. This is the newest face on it, which is a much more brazen and blatantly raw face if we're talking about Donald Trump, but it is a continuation and an intensification of something that's already been happening. Well, Hillary Clinton was a lot less gifted rhetorically than Barack Obama in terms of charisma and ability to communicate with people, so that, I think, stripped away a lot of the support that she really came into this election a lot weaker than Obama left. In comparison to who she was running against, she should have mopped the floor with him if she had run a moderately competent progressive campaign, which she really didn't. You know, it really wasn't until she needed the Bernie Sanders votes post-primaries that she really even started talking about things like raising the minimum wage and free college education. And I think by that point, a lot of people weren't very convinced, or it certainly didn't blast a lot of people out of bed on election day. Nonetheless, you still have this problem where smooth-talking individuals in the Democratic Party have been able to convince Americans for a long time that if you just vote Democratic, things will be okay, and that has not been the case in recent decades with the rise of inequality between the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. Now, by the way, a lot of people like to pick on Americans with regard to this point, but it's not just an American thing. Obama was very skilled in his use of rhetoric to the point where almost the entire world bought the rhetoric. If you look closely at the public opinion polls, if you look very closely at them, When President Bush left office and Obama came in office, the BBC did a multinational survey across the world, different regions and countries, and they asked whether people had confidence in the United States to do the right thing in world affairs. And most countries throughout the world said they did not have confidence in the United States and the Bush administration when he left office. Enter the Obama administration and all of his rhetoric about democracy and human rights and development, and that we were going to get out of these dumb wars like in Iraq. And I'll give it to the Obama administration, to this president. He was very active traveling the United States and the world, trying to cultivate a much more positive image of the United States. Now, as we've already talked about, the policy didn't really change. Still had drone strikes, assassinations, illegal wars on multiple fronts. It's just that the rhetoric was much nicer, and he gave lip service to these principles of human rights and democracy and development. It worked like a charm. If you look at the actual BBC polls, most countries that were surveyed, most people said that all of a sudden they had faith in the United States to do the right thing in world affairs. In 2015, the Pew Research Center, based out of Princeton, did a multinational survey. And they found that there was a majority approval of the United States, and it had a very positive image throughout most all countries surveyed in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe. There's only one region where they didn't have a majority support across countries surveyed, and I think you can guess which one I left off the list. It's not that hard to figure out. We're talking about the Middle East, the people who had actually experienced the wars the United States was fighting, whether it be in Syria or Libya, or continued in Iraq, and so on and so forth. So it took the people who actually had to feel the effects of the militarism. They were the only ones who were able to cut through the crap in terms of the rhetoric. The rest of the world bought into this rhetoric, too. If you go back and look at President Obama's speeches, and I've done this pretty closely, there was never this talk of things like oil interests or power, maximizing power. You would see that kind of rhetoric going back to the George H.W. Bush administration and even the Carter administration before it, the Clinton administration, and in particularly in their national security strategies of these different presidents and in their speeches. And through the second Bush administration as well. This was one thing that was very different with the Obama administration rhetorically, that he went out of his way to not use that kind of power politics rhetoric in terms of articulating national security strategies. And it worked. A lot of people thought that the United States was engaged in a much more positive role in the world because of this rhetoric. And it's interesting, and you go from Obama to Trump, and the approval ratings just sort of fall off a cliff. Now that the rhetoric has been stripped away, and this administration has made no bones about not caring about the Paris Climate Accord, or things like the international community, and so on and so forth. You look at the approval rating of the United States from Obama to Trump. At the end of Obama, according to the Pew Research Center, they surveyed 37 different nations right at the end of his administration, an average of 64% approval across these countries that they surveyed for the United States when Obama was leaving office. Well, that's not that different than the domestic rating, right, which was about 60%. So that falls right in the ballpark. Trump came into office right at the beginning of Trump. Now, he's gone further since then. So my guess would be if the numbers were resurveyed, they'd be less than this now and significantly less with him spitting in the face of the Paris Climate Accord. But right when he came into office, 49% approval. Went from 64 to 49 overnight. This is the problem when we talk about the issue of propaganda and rhetoric, that unless people are paying close attention, they don't recognize the way in which they're being manipulated through the use of language. So that's one of the big challenges, that people are just going to need to pay more attention to what's been happening if they want to conceptualize an alternative future. Another big problem I can speak firsthand about, because I've spent 2 decades in higher education, is the decline of public education in the United States. I think this finally came full circle with the election of Donald Trump. It finally became impossible to deny that there were going to be real, tangible consequences for the dumbing down of education. The fact that you can have a president who so blatantly and regularly thumbs his nose at facts and evidence-based reasoning, and so shamelessly, and can get elected, really speaks volumes about the decline of intellectual culture in a country like the United States. Now, this has been something going on for a long time. These things don't happen overnight. But from my vantage point in higher education, it was very obvious that we were building to this for a long time. We've had the quasi-privatization of higher education institutions with the dramatic cut in state tuition or tuition funding, which has basically been outsourced to students and parents who now have to borrow massive amounts of money to pay for these degrees, which were almost virtually free 30, 40 years ago. Decline in tenure means it's become much harder for professors to take risks and become more critical in the classroom and challenge received truths or conventional wisdom or alleged conventional wisdom because they have to worry about keeping their job and angering students who are increasingly seen as consumers rather than people who are there to learn and become citizens and intellectuals. And you can do both, by the way. That's a radical idea these days, that you could learn things in higher education and build vocational skills. But that's not what we've been seeing in recent years. We've been seeing the rise of this idea that education means earning, and it's about vocation, and you don't need things like a political science or government class or a history class, and people just need to know how to stick somebody with a needle when they come into the doctor's office. And that is the death of intellectualism, when education becomes nothing more than training. And that's what has happened in the last 20 years. With the rise of professionalization, and this has been something very much driven by an administrative corporate class in higher education, people who have come to power in the last two or three decades, who are not faculty, which used to be where a lot of administration was drawn from, faculty who would serve part-time in administrative positions. Well, we have seen a move away from that toward professional administrators who are taught in this modern era to run schools like businesses. And they've got this idea, again, that learning means earning, and they've pushed the idea of professionalization. This is something that was far less powerful 20, 30, 40 years ago and is much more powerful today. What do I mean by professionalization? There's an idea that has taken hold, and I can tell you this for a fact, although I've only been in higher education as an adult for 20 years, the historical memory goes back probably, I guess you would say, another 20 on top of that with the people in my departments that I've worked alongside who remember the early 1980s and late 1970s. This idea that you're not there to change the world. You're not there to educate people, to challenge the system and the political economic status quo and think critically. You're there to publish things in academic journals and hopefully keep your head down and avoid all the bad pressure and bad press that comes from places like Fox News and elsewhere if you do speak out. And your job is not to reach the public with your research and be a public intellectual. Your job is to produce articles that maybe will get cited by one person and read by one person in each department across the country in your political science field, if you're lucky. And that's really sort of the death of higher education, and we've seen that in modern times. I gave an example of this anecdotally. I was at a conference recently in Chicago in April. It's one of the major flagship conferences in political science. And in the last couple of years, they have been actively patrolling the halls of the Palmer House, making sure that everybody has a badge. Why does everybody need a badge? Well, if you didn't pay to get in, then get the hell out. God forbid there would be this idea that it could be open to people in the public who might actually have something to learn from intellectuals. We don't want that. We're there to make money and for people to get conference presentations, to go on a resume to get somebody a job or get them tenure. So when you look at professionalization through that lens, it doesn't look quite as good as the name sounds. It's a radically different system than what existed 20, 30, 40 years ago, where people previously could have maybe gotten tenure just based on teaching alone and just making a difference in the classroom. And by being a public intellectual, that was something that was actually valued. Now, I don't want to talk badly about the institution I'm currently affiliated with because they're one of the few that I've found that actually does value people being public intellectuals and encourages that. But increasingly, we're seeing a move away from that. And that is where we have a really big problem in the United States intellectually, because who fills the vacuum if intellectuals and scholars don't speak up? Who fills the vacuum? Donald Trump fills the vacuum. Fox News fills the vacuum. People who are anti-intellectual fill the vacuum. We've seen a recent survey of Americans where something like half of Republicans now say, college, bad. Think about that for a minute. College is bad. It's quite a nuanced analysis. No, well, not really. But we all know there are problems with higher education that need to be dealt with, but that sort of simplistic, knee-jerk, tear it all down and burn it up mentality will make things worse than it is even now. So what's going on here in terms of this propaganda system? Well, it's been very effective, whether we're talking about media propaganda and a failure to challenge the current political economic status quo, and this is something that's been well known among political communication scholars, that journalists do not historically do a very good job of challenging government rhetoric and government officials and propaganda. Whether we're talking about the media or government propaganda itself or the failure of schools to educate people critically, it's led to a lot of Americans accepting utter falsehoods. And until they recognize that these things are falsehoods, I don't know that we can move forward to where we need to go. 60% of Americans in 2015 said, it's still possible in America if you work hard to get ahead. 54% said that same year that the U.S. is not divided between haves and have-nots. Half of America has zero financial assets. Half. And there's still this idea that there aren't have-nots. And half of the country has zero financial wealth in the wealthiest country in the world, where wealth and being a have is defined primarily through tangible financial assets. Half of people don't have any. We still think, majority of Americans, that there is no such thing as a divide between people who have and people who don't. And this idea of working hard to get ahead, by the way, this may have been true in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s, where people saw increased incomes on average, where the minimum wage was going up because of government action, where people were part of unions and they pressured for higher wages, and people who worked harder did get ahead and made more money. That's not been the case for 40 years. We know this very clearly by looking at the statistics. Families have worked, really since the 1970s, the number of work hours has gone up by a third. Male incomes have gone down by a third. As a result, we've had stagnating family and household incomes. People are working harder for the same amount of money. This idea that you have this Horatio Alger story where people go from rags to riches is nonsense. 60% of Americans still believe that if you work hard, you will get ahead. People have been working harder for 40 years now, and they are falling behind. People have become more unhealthy in America in terms of the obesity epidemic. Healthcare costs approximately double every decade, and incomes are not doubling. I know you all know that. They're not doubling, and healthcare costs do. The cost of higher education has gone up 100% in the last 20 years, too. Household debt. As a percentage of household income was 68% in 1980. As of 2011, 112%. The most common cause of bankruptcy today is healthcare costs. Big surprise. And the people who declare bankruptcy, most of them had healthcare. It wasn't very good healthcare. This is what a broken system looks like. Now, if you're working harder as a family and more hours, and you're more unhealthy than you used to be, and you're more in debt than you used to be, whether it's household debt in terms of education or credit cards or healthcare costs or whatever. You're working harder than you used to, you're more unhealthy, and you're more in debt than you've ever been, and cost of living has gone up more than anything you've seen in terms of your pay. You've fallen behind, clearly. That's a squeezing of the middle class. And most Americans have not been able to recognize that yet. And until they do, it's not going to be addressed. Until that happens. I think that's something important to point out. In terms of propaganda, one big problem is not just people being suckered into accepting this political rhetoric, because there are a lot of people who vote who do buy into this propaganda from the Democratic Party that they're going to make things better, despite things getting worse. There's a whole other group of Americans who have become, I guess for lack of a better term, I'd say diverted and alienated. They don't pay attention to what's going on in politics at all. They don't vote. This is roughly half of America. They're not voting. They're not paying attention to the news. They don't know what's going on. They've completely, divorced themselves from the political process. We're not going to make a lot of progress in terms of building some sort of progressive change until many of these people are shaken out of their apathy. Much of this diversion comes from the rise of cable news, to be honest, and cable in general. This has been something political scientists have documented. With the rise of cable, you've seen the massive proliferation of huge numbers of choices in terms of entertainment, where people have gravitated away from the news because they can. people who wouldn't have followed the news in previous generations had to because there weren't many media choices, but now we live in the era of a million choices and people aren't paying attention. Also, one interesting thing that's been shown, consumerism. Consumerism has been used as a sort of aphrodisiac for people to tune out. Because the cost of electronics and goods has gone down so much in the last 10 years, this has served as a way of pacifying people and created a sort of false consciousness where people think, well, maybe there isn't such a thing as have-nots. Everybody has a cell phone, don't they? Anybody can get a television. The cost of TVs has gone down dramatically in the last 10 years. Cell phones, too. Toys for children. So we've gotten to the point where people can benefit from these electronics and these goods, which are very entertaining, right? You can buy dozens of used DVDs for 50 cents or a dollar each, and you can live on your pile of shit and not have health care and not be able to afford to send your kids to college, and if you do, be indebted permanently for it or cash in your 401k or your pension or whatever it is. And that's one of the issues, this idea of false consciousness. We need to get beyond this idea that we have it good and people have it good just because they have electronics. I've seen this a lot with students in the interviews I've done as I've pursued a project I'm working on with regards to inequality in America and why people don't recognize that there is a divide in this country. Why not? Many people I interview, countless people say, well, because I have all these modern conveniences that people didn't have 50 years ago. I have the cell phone, the computer, the television. And in that sense, people's lives have gotten easier, but what good are those things if you don't have health care or education? What good are they outside of being a diversion? So this is one of the issues that we have to deal with, you know, the being flooded with cheap goods. There's also a well-known correlation, or well-established at least. I don't know if it's well-known among people who are big on consumerism. The consumerism is inversely linked to political engagement. That the more committed you are to consuming things, the less likely you are to pay attention to politics and vote. That's not to say people shouldn't be consuming things because you have to consume things to live, whether it's have clothing on your back or eat or whatnot or whatever. But the more people care about those things, the more that they become demobilized from politics. And that's what we've been seeing. When we talk about alienation, there's this idea that there was a Trump uprising. If there was a Trump uprising in this last election, it was a very anemic one. There were these terms thrown around like populist, white working class rebellion, uprising. I don't want to say there wasn't some kind of uprising, but really it was more of a demobilization than anything else. What we have seen, if you look closely at the exit polls and the voting data, is that the Democratic Party lost 3.5 times more working class Rust Belt voters than the Republican Party under Trump gained when you compare the 2012 presidential election to 2016. So what happened was the same old Republican base turned out in 2016 as they did in 2012, but what propelled him into office was the demobilization of the other side. And this is what the Democratic Party has fundamentally failed to recognize when you hear them constantly obsessing over Vladimir Putin did it. Well, certainly there are concerns about the Trump administration and their wheeling and dealing, and this whole art of the deal, let's do horse trading of policy outcomes for financial benefits, which I've documented in my writings in a dozen different ways this happens. This kind of cronyism certainly is a concern. But if the idea is that the Democratic Party lost in this election purely because of Vladimir Putin, that's an absurdity that has never been documented in terms of actual voting and why people voted. So I think we have to be careful about that too. One last thing I would point out. We've seen a real failure of the left in the United States, or what's called the left, what's left of the left, which plays into this in terms of obstacles for change. We've seen a decline in critical thinking in higher education that I've already talked about. There were these people who used to be left public intellectuals in the 1960s coming out of the Vietnam era through the 1970s and 80s, and most of that's gone now. And that is a problem. We have to take back higher educational institutions if we want there to be real change. The decline of unions has been another big part of this. So many Americans today are afraid of speaking up in the workplace because they don't have basic worker protections through a union contract, and they have employment at will. Their employers will, by the way, not theirs if they get fired. They didn't decide that. So these are things that we need to address. What's called the left today in the United States, we've got a lot of public intellectuals who write a lot of things for different venues and mediums, and that's certainly great. But one thing I've noticed in recent years is that we've become profoundly good at being against things. A lot of progressive and left intellectuals. And they haven't spent much time, we haven't spent much time sort of talking about what we're for and what we want to build. People are great at criticizing the Democratic Party, which I've spent plenty of time on, and the Republican Party and the system, but they haven't taken the time to talk about and develop where we need to go. It's gotten to the point where when we talk about public intellectualism, I learned very little from Left Online and Left Print Media today. It's not that there aren't smart people working in it, but we need to move beyond the criticism. And that's part of what this presentation has been about, trying to flesh out where we're going with these anti-Trump protests and how we could build something more productive than just opposing a single president, because if that's what it is, then the air gets sucked out of the room once he's gone. So we're really not left with anything outside of that. Now, I will say in terms of a positive, to conclude all this, Karl Marx had an interesting quote. He said, men make their own history, we should say people today, properly sensitive to gender equality. Men make their own history, people make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances. I don't think it's an accident that we've seen the first real mass wave of protest in the last 10 years in an era of record inequality. Really the biggest protests and wave upon wave of protests, whether we're talking about Black Lives Matter or the Fight for 15 or the Madison anti-Scott Walker protests or Occupy Wall Street or now the healthcare protests, the anti-Trump protests. I don't think it's an accident that all of these things are happening one after another at this era of crisis in terms of healthcare costs, education costs, declining incomes, record inequality. I think what's going to happen when we talk about this quote from Karl Marx is that as people become more and more economically insecure and as we move more and more towards environmental crisis, there's just going to be more and more pressure for people to act. Will that action come quickly enough to deal with some of these problems? I don't know. Anyone who tells you they have an answer is lying. I hope that we can act sooner than later, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Can you comment on the amount of the national treasure that has been devoted to the development of the nuclear project, both weapons and medicine and the production of electricity?
Well, I spent a lot of time as an undergraduate as an anti-nuclear activist in central Illinois, because Illinois, as people probably know, has more nuclear power plants than just about anywhere else. I guess if we're talking about cost, we shouldn't kid ourselves that this was a massive cost sustained really by taxpayers to develop the whole viability, to the extent that it is viable, nuclear energy going back to the 1940s and 50s. I think you're probably talking about somewhere along the order of hundreds of billions of dollars from the numbers I remember reading years ago, in terms of not just developing the nuclear technology, which the government had to have a hand in, but insuring these companies that were then going to take the reins, because no private insurer was going to pay for the danger of something like a nuclear power plant. They just wouldn't do it. It was an entirely unnecessary technology. It was a complete waste and dangerous, in the sense that now we are stuck with radioactive waste for thousands or even tens of thousands of years, or possibly even longer. We talk about radioactive decay and isotopes and how dangerous these things are, not to mention the environmental dangers. I mean, talking about even places like Braidwood, which is not that far from Chicago, where they've had problems with tritium leaking into the groundwater, so there's not only a financial drain but an ecological cost. And that's not even to talk about the danger of nuclear weapons, right, and the amount of money spent capitalizing, developing, and reconstituting those, which we do every generation. I think you're talking on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars, if not even trillions in the long term, in terms of storage of the nuclear waste and the other kind of damage that could come along with that along the way. Fortunately, if there is a fortunately in that, it seems to be a technology on life support, or essentially dead at this point. Since Three Mile Island, we haven't seen the building of nuclear power plants, new ones. I was on the front lines of fighting this in central Illinois in Bloomington Normal, because there was talk at the Exelon plant in Clinton about adding another nuclear reactor, and that would have been the first one added in decades. It did not happen, fortunately, because this technology has become so unviable in terms of competing with alternative energy sources, whether they be renewable or non. So I think we're sort of beyond the hump right now in terms of this danger of creating more nuclear power, but we've still got to deal with the after effect of it in terms of nuclear energy. And then, of course, there's always the specter of nuclear war as well, which has been a problem under both political parties in terms of belligerence towards China and Russia. And that's something that can only be limited through people being more vigilant in terms of activists. So hopefully that deals with the questions you have a little bit. I think I'm on your side when we talk about the danger. That's the challenge moving forward. If nuclear energy is not making a comeback, then we're talking about nuclear weapons and the cost. And I would go beyond just nuclear weapons. The entire idea of spending hundreds of billions of dollars on the military every year has directly come at the cost of education and healthcare. It's been very parasitic. It's benefited some people in terms of military contractors. It's been very harmful for the average American in terms of monetary priorities and infrastructure and development and health.
The protests that are occurring now, they're not really covered well on the general news, but the information seeps through somehow. We see there are a lot of them. How are they just spontaneously developed, or are there organizers who are doing this?
Well, there's a certain level of spontaneity if people are seeing these things advertised online and they decide to join. And you know, as an academic and an intellectual and an activist, I've played the role of an organizer at various points in my life in college and as a union organizer years ago. But my role right now is more as one of an intellectual teacher and activist. I'm really not on the front lines of planning all of these marches and protests. I'm more lucky that I have the time to participate in them as a supporter. So obviously there's a lot of hard work going into that as well. From what I've seen with regards to the, if we're talking about the education, you know, March for Science, the healthcare protests, a lot of the people who are there, some of them are motivated just by a general sense of caring about others and having empathy, but a lot of it, a huge amount of it, is people who have their own skin in the game. People who have been helped in some way by the Affordable Care Act in terms of not being denied based on a pre-existing condition, or they got some sort of subsidy help, or they got on Medicaid, or somebody who's been very badly hurt by the system prior to the Affordable Care Act, or even during, and they've got a tangible financial stake. And with regard to education, a lot of the people I saw at the March for Science, where I was in the Lehigh Valley area, educators, people who have a stake in community education and funding of schools and seeing them get resources. So I think this is one of the big things driving modern protest, this idea that with rising economic insecurity, people are fighting back against the loss of resources and the loss of things that they need. There's this idea of tangible grievances. This actually goes back in political science more than half a century. This political scientist named David Truman came up with a theory called disturbance theory, and he said people will become active the more disturbed they get, not just mentally, but in terms of things being taken away from them, perceived injustice, losing financial benefits or protections, their health care, their job, growing economic insecurity. And I think that's what we're really talking about here, that the stink has become so bad in terms of rising inequality and declining security that people just can't turn their head anymore.
But who is organizing it? They don't spontaneously get together.
Well, in the case of the last protest I was at, the healthcare protest, it was an interesting eclectic group of different people. There were some of it was union-based through the SEIU. A lot of it was community-based through some various faith-based organizations who were very much interested in different dimensions of oppression and inequality, whether it's for people of color or women or the poor. Part of it was women's rights groups like Planned Parenthood. It was a very eclectic mix, and that was the most encouraging part about it, that if there's going to be this building up toward a progressive mass change, that it will have to unite people across different demographics and identities. And that's what's starting to happen now with the anti-Trump protests. We don't want it to be just, well, it's a huge group of people because everybody hates Donald Trump. And then, it, you know, if he's gone, then it dissipates. I think what we want to see is more of what we've just seen with building some sort of progressive, proactive, positive vision across many different groups, whether it's laborers or women's rights groups or faith-based groups or local community groups. Those are really the people that have been active, and we're going to have to see more of it.
Universal health care, a lot of people get that confused, that we have kind of three systems of healthcare. One is private insurance companies. The second kind is national healthcare that they have in Canada, and actually we have a system of national healthcare here with Medicare, where the government is the insurance agent and as such tends to control the cost of services. And the third kind is like socialized medicine, like they have in England, and we have that here too with the Veterans Administration, where the government owns the healthcare facilities and employs the people who deliver the healthcare. So when we talk about universal healthcare, that's actually different than those two systems or three systems. Forget that. We need a national healthcare system in this country. But that my question really reveals an appalling. Hillary won the popular vote by 3 million people. It was because of the Electoral College that she didn't win the presidency. So I would like you to comment on that.
I think they're both important things, and I would agree. When I say universal health care, I'm referring specifically to the idea of single-payer-based care, where government is the single payer for all people. So the idea of a nationalized, socialized health care. Yeah, that's what I've been calling for and what the people who I've been involved in demonstrating with have been calling for. Not an Affordable Care Act, which expands private health care and has some sort of expansion of Medicaid and subsidies, which will continue growing to the sky for private insurers who, even under the ACA, have been charging 10% more a year. It's obviously unsustainable, and it can't continue. At the very, very, very least, there has to be, if we can't get to universal health care immediately, there has to be some sort of cost controls in the short term, at the very least. But that's not really my long-term vision, as I said. Mine is the idea of single-payer care, and I think a lot of Americans are moving in that direction. Most recent surveys I've seen say more than half are in support of it. It's just something that has to be, we need to build up a larger mass support for. Supposedly, there are something like 105 members of the House, Democrats, who say they support this. So, you know, put your money where your mouth is. They said they've supported it. That's great, but we'll see if they can get a majority of the Democratic Party and implement it, great, and if not, they should all be thrown out of there, one or the other. I think my inclinations lay exactly with where yours are in terms of health care. In terms of the Hillary Clinton thing and the Electoral College, I think obviously that's a huge scandal. The fact that you can have an outcome where the winner of the majority vote loses the election because of the Electoral College suggests that you have a fundamental flaw in the democratic system that's not democratic and was created not to be democratic. If you look back at the writings of Alexander Hamilton talking about the Electoral College as a way to control the public and the population, it's certainly done a very good job of deterring representation of any kind of democratic kind. So it is something that needs to disappear. I don't know that it's going to until there's either mass pressure or the Democratic Party wins a couple elections via the Electoral College and Republicans get screwed and there's enough bipartisan anger to get rid of it. One of those two things will get rid of it. And we're not close to either one right now. So we'll see what happens.
You mentioned propaganda and people's misinformed views in this country. I wonder if you're familiar with Alex Carey's book, Taking the Risk Out of Democracy. If you could comment on that, the American business model, and for how long it's been engaged in shaping American perceptions about capitalism and Americanism, conjoining the two. And then the Powell memo subsequent to that, then how it's brought us to this point.
Sure. Well, I think if we're talking about Supreme Court Justice Powell, I mean, he's part of a broader framework of elite contempt for the whole idea of democracy, which we've seen through modern times, particularly in public opinion surveys that show that political leaders don't have any interest in democratic representation, that they are more interested in forming their own policy proposals and trying to sell them to people, which brings it into what you're talking about with Carey's book on taking the risk out of democracy and the whole idea of corporate propaganda. I mean, this is something that's been around for 100 years. We talk about the rise of mass consumerism. That's really when it took off. And for a while, it was easier to sell the idea of the propaganda that you could have the good life through consumerism and not by worrying about things like maybe politics and this idea of rising apathy. That may have been easier for a long time between the 40s and the 70s because there was more opportunity available for the average American in terms of higher economic growth, higher incomes in general, and so on and so forth. But I think that I think we're in the middle of an era now where it's becoming harder. It's becoming a lot harder for political leaders to use propaganda to manipulate people as people suffer under greater economic insecurity. From my own research, which focuses heavily on the idea of propaganda, there are some things that it's hard to do with propaganda. One particularly is to convince people to believe the opposite of things they've had direct experience with. So for the example of the Iraq War, as people became more aware of Americans dying, as they knew people who went to Iraq and came back hurt, maimed, or killed, it became harder and harder to sell this idea of this just war. With regards to domestic policy, things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, you can try all you want to sell these policies, but people who have experience with these things, it's a hard sell. It really is when people have these direct, tangible experiences. And it's gotten to the point where we are starting to see, as I mentioned, the rise of this general and sort of vague sense of anger where people know there's something wrong. You're not going to be able to convince people in mass in this country that there isn't something wrong. Whether they can fully put their finger on it is still something we're working on. But it has become harder. People know there's something wrong. People are increasingly figuring it out, whether it's ecological crisis or economic insecurity, inequality, and so on and so on. They know they're paying exorbitant health care costs and that higher education is through the roof. You're not going to convince people of otherwise. The question now is how to strengthen these critiques and get people active. So I think we're moving into an era where it's getting harder and harder for that manipulation to be as effective as it used to be when people lived under a system that was, relatively speaking, much more functional than it is today. We have such a dysfunctional political and economic system. I think there's this idea that people are getting increasingly rowdy and protesting, and a lot of this is racialized too, in the sense that when you talk about Black Lives Matter being one of the big movements that's pushing against this, not just in terms of the protests, but in terms of criminalization of communities in general and people of color, that people aren't tolerating it anymore and that they're speaking up. So the idea that you have to put people down physically because they're not going to tolerate it.
You touched upon this, the idea of the creation of a mass party. One of the terms that some people have heard bandied about currently is that we are in a pre-party state. I tend to agree with that. What you were talking about with regards to, you know, creating something larger. I mean, from my perspective, this is where we must go. So what is the other thing that we could look at? Well, people talked about the Green Party, okay, a third party. The one takeaway that I had from November was that I actually thought that Jill Stein was going to do a whole lot better than she did. I mean, she, you know, got 1 million votes, whoop-de-doo. That's like, what was it, like 0.75% of the total vote? And when you look at the fact that half the population didn't even vote, how can we move forward to get to that point where we actually have a viable option, which would obviously be something other than the Democrats or, for that matter, the Green Party?
Well, it's a good point and good question because, you know, this is one of the things when we talk about modern leftist public intellectuals being really good at being against things. That doesn't help when we recognize that we have to build a mass party. Now, I guess for the anarchists out there, they might be happy with the idea of collective self-governance, but we're nowhere near that. Not even close. Feels like that would be 1,000 years away. So what do we do? Well, I think one possibility is, I'm sort of agnostic on the issue in terms of whether it could be an alternative party or the Democratic Party. I'm not obviously a supporter of the modern Democratic Party because of what it's become, but it certainly would be possible if we're talking about one approach or way that this could play out, where grassroots forces sort of slowly claw back control of that party or even over a short period of time. And if people say, well, that's not going to happen, well, Republicans have been doing it for 40 years to their party. The right wing through primaries, they've been doing it for decades. So certainly there is a precedent there if people wanted to go that route. I, for most of my adult life, I'd say I've voted third party, Green Party, occasionally Democratic in terms of this idea of pragmatic voting in Pennsylvania as a swing state. I'm really not the kind of person who's going to make this into a holy writ one way or another, because I believe it's counterproductive. I know a lot of people who call themselves leftists love to spend all their time bitching about the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And for me, when I see that kind of stuff, whether it's Truthout or Counterpunch or these other websites, it's like, change the record. I heard this a million times already. I know what that party is. I don't need to hear it again. That party can be rebuilt, possibly, or we could go another direction where there's a third party that's built up. I think the problem that comes up there is that the system is rigged. The money, 90% of the time, the candidate who has more money wins. And it's not the third party people, the Green Party people particularly. The Green Party is in a state of disarray. They have 50 different state parties that just have people who run for offices and almost no coordination whatsoever on a national level outside of running vanity candidates who are sort of like what people are increasingly calling third or fourth rate celebrities. I'm not trying to talk badly about Jill Stein or Ralph Nader because I appreciate these people's politics. But the system has been rigged for a long time now against third parties. So short of some sort of mass upheaval, uprising, of changing of these rules in terms of campaign finance rules or state ballot access rules, which keep out third parties, or these presidential debates that keep them out, unless you change those things, they're going nowhere. That system has been, that route has been blocked for a long time now. Short of being a rich person like a Donald Trump or a Ross Perot who can spend their own money to run ads and maybe run as a third-party candidate as Trump had talked about initially. Short of that kind of uprising, your other alternative is the Democratic Party. Now, I'm not, again, the kind of person who's really going to be putting forward a lot of energy with that. I really can see myself as more of someone who's a student of and studies and participates in social movements. So what I am trying to do is something different in the sense that I believe that if we can build up a mass pressure from below culturally in the United States and a critical consciousness and a mobilization, that whatever parties exist, mass parties moving forward are going to be pressured by that. I think if we talk about sort of the New Deal era of the 1930s through the 1970s, both political parties were much more progressive than they are now because of that strong base, organized base on the left, which was partially based in higher education and largely through unions and through the civil rights movement and other groups as well. So that's really sort of my approach at this point. The goal is to build up from below, so whatever parties continue to exist have to take that seriously and change their politics. If there are alliances that can be made along the way with individuals in the Democratic Party who are in favor of the kind of politics that we want, then I think it'd be foolish not to pursue those. I have met a few of those political leaders in Pennsylvania in the state legislature, and I'm happy to try and work with those people if there are opportunities, and there do seem to be. But not interested in working with the Democratic Party just because they're not Donald Trump. So that's the best answer I think I can give in terms of nuance.
The corporations seem to be the instrument that's being used. It goes back to the Powell Memo in 71. Also, the National Association of Manufacturers in 71 moved their headquarters to Washington, D.C. The corporation, as I see it, is kind of a combination of the mafia and the plantation. Now, somehow the businesses have managed to turn the corporation into a permanent thing with limited liability. How can we take the corporation's status away from businesses?
Well, it's a great question in terms of what it definitely is relevant to the topic of the presentation too, right? Because we're talking about this idea of capitalism in crisis and where we go from here. I can say in terms of my own personal background that, you know, I made a decision when I was a late teenager that I didn't want to be involved in corporate America because of the rise of worker insecurity and this idea that corporations aren't democratic entities, and without unions there's no democratic say in a corporate workplace. So I made a very conscious decision in my life to focus on public education. And, you know, I sort of tried to live that, and, you know, in terms of my actual occupational life, in terms of being a union organizer and this idea, which is directly based on socialist principles, that people should have a direct say in the workplace through collective bargaining, through unions, and that kind of empowerment. So I think in the short term, that's one thing that we need to be doing is people need to be trying to reclaim the workplace one step at a time, and rebuilding unions is the way to do that. And I think they should be the kind of unions based on this idea of, if we're talking about sort of mid to long term thinking, which admittedly we're nowhere near right now, the idea of democratic ownership in the workplace. The people who contribute to these companies running these businesses ought to be the people making the decisions and owning them. Now that's, you can say that's pie in the sky or idealistic. That's sort of my philosophy in terms of mid to long term moving forward. I think you can also try and sort of, while looking at that, recognize that there's other dimensions to this too. You know, we're talking about the idea of universal health care as a socialized policy, right? So there are different things that we can be doing in terms of moving toward a socialized system that we don't have. So I think there's a lot of different dimensions where these things can move forward. But none of that's going to happen until people are willing to rise up in the workplace and defend themselves and form their own organizations. People are so afraid today of being fired. But on the other hand, people say, you know, there's the old cliche, necessity is the mother of invention. When people get desperate enough, maybe they will, once the system really breaks fully. And I'd like to think that's not going to happen, that people wouldn't have to be pushed to that level of extreme before they'd become open to some sort of systematic alternative to what we have. But it may take another depression for that to happen, for people to develop that kind of critical class consciousness to the point where they have nothing left invested in the system. There's one statistic I will cite that I forgot to cite, and I just didn't have time. The Pew Research Center, within the last, I believe it was a year or so, they found that half of people who earn under $45,000 like the idea of capitalism, and the other half of people who earn under $45,000 a year like the idea of socialism. Compared to people making over $90,000 a year, in which three quarters of them like the idea of capitalism, not socialism. So you do the math there, figure out what it takes to get to where you want to go if you are a socialist. Growing economic insecurity, crisis, economic crash, potential collapse. I think this is what we're talking about realistically at this point, if there's ever going to be any sort of real productive discussion about alternatives to a corporate capitalistic system.